Good morning, friends. You know, I think it's fair to say that in the Gospels, some of Jesus' disciples have leading roles, while others have bit parts. They're the stars, like Peter, the rock, but who also denied Jesus three times. And there's John, the disciple that Jesus loved, his brother James. In fact, Peter, James, and John seem to have been apostle insiders. They're the ones, for example, who got VIP passage to the Transfiguration. But some of the other disciples, Thaddeus, Bartholomew, Simon the Zealot, if they're mentioned at all, it's mainly to fill out the roster. One disciple is even called James the Lesser to distinguish him from his A-list colleague. And there's even a second stringer, Matthias, picked to replace Judas Iscariot after that unfortunate incident in the garden. Tough for him. And then there's Thomas. In today's reading from John, we have what's unquestionably the defining gospel story for this disciple, also called Thomas Didymus or Thomas the Twin. In the three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Thomas is pretty much a bit player, mentioned only as one of the 12. But John's gospel features him much more prominently. In fact, in John, Thomas figures in three different stories. But of course, it's our reading from today that everyone remembers. It's the story that, for all time, brands Thomas as the dubious disciple, the notorious skeptic, the doubting Thomas. So let's review. In today's reading, Thomas has been somewhere else when the risen Christ first appears to the assembled disciples. And later, when he joins their company, they try to convince him that they've seen the Lord, but he's not buying it. "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe," he says. Now, this is a really bad move from a PR perspective, because henceforth and forever he'll be known as Doubting Thomas and become an object lesson for generations of the faithful. That term, Doubting Thomas, has entered our vocabulary as a person who is skeptical, who demands proof for everything. But in fact, it's not actually in the Bible. Except, you know, sometimes in one of those little sermon or one of those little section headings that they put in centuries later. Nevertheless, kids in Sunday school are admonished not to be a doubting Thomas, but to believe without question. But I think that Thomas gets kind of a bad rap here. And let me tell you why. As I said, in John's gospel, Thomas figures prominently in three separate incidents, including today's reading, which is the last of the three. The first is described in John chapter 11. Jesus has just told his disciples that he plans to return to Judea because his friend Lazarus has died. But the disciples don't want any of that. You see, the last few times Jesus has been in Judea, the Jews tried to seize him and kill him. So the disciples have a pretty good reason why they didn't want to return to Judea. They were afraid that Jesus would be killed and maybe them with him. But when it becomes clear that Jesus plans to take the trip, despite their best efforts to convince him otherwise, it's Thomas who speaks up. "Then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, 'Let us also go, that we may die with him.'" So in this story, far from being the thoughtless skeptic, Thomas is the one who's willing to follow Jesus, even if it means risking his own life. So shouldn't we call him Brave Thomas, or Faithful Thomas, or Suicidal Thomas, depending on how you look at it? Certainly not Doubting Thomas. The second story involving Thomas is in John chapter 14. Jesus has just said to his disciples, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My parents' house has many rooms. If this were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I'm going." But Thomas, always the straight shooter, says to Jesus, "Lord, we don't even know where you're going, so how can we know the way?" That's a pretty good question, don't you think? As so often happens in John's gospel, Jesus has been speaking in these lofty, poetic terms about some mansion in the sky where he's going to take them. But always the down-to-earth disciple, Thomas, says what the other disciples were probably all thinking. "Jesus, can you put that in terms we can understand? How can we get there if we don't even know where to go?" Now, note it's not that Thomas was hesitant to follow Jesus. He'd love to follow Jesus. He's not all that clear on just what he's supposed to do. And so he does a sensible thing. He asks. And who says guys never ask for directions? Anyway, given this story, why don't we call him Sensible Thomas, or Honest Thomas, or Plain Spoken Thomas, or maybe even A Little Slow on the Uptake Thomas? But no, it's always Doubting Thomas. And it's that last story from John's Gospel, today's reading, that forever tarred poor Thomas with that epithet. But is it really fair? For one thing, Thomas wasn't the first to doubt testimony of the resurrection. Remember in Mark's Gospel, from which we read on Easter Sunday, we find these words. "Now, after Jesus rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven demons. She went out and told those who had been with him while they were mourning and weeping. But when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they would not believe it." Did you catch that? They would not believe it. Now, maybe it was the fact that it was a woman giving them this news. Jewish law specifies that to be considered reliable, a witness must be a man who is not deaf, or mentally or morally unsuitable. Women, in most cases, are not considered to be reliable witnesses. Or maybe there was something about Mary herself that caused them to doubt her word. She's popularly remembered as a Reformed prostitute, but there's really not much evidence for that. The reference to her being possessed by seven demons more likely refers to mental illness than to moral failings. So perhaps that's why the disciples were slow to believe her story. Maybe they thought that the strain of the last few days had unhinged her a bit. She was having hallucinations. Who knows? But the fact remains that they didn't believe her testimony. But do we tar the whole bunch of them without doubting label? Not in your life. It's just Thomas who gets this rap. Seems a bit unfair, doesn't it? And maybe Thomas wasn't so much doubting the Lord as doubting the testimony of these very human witnesses. Just as the other disciples might have wondered if Mary Magdalene had been having hallucinations, maybe Thomas wondered the same thing about them. They too had all been under a lot of stress, after all. When Jesus appeared to them the first time, they were locked into a house, the gospel says, for fear of the Jews. And ask yourself this: would you have believed it? What if someone told you that your friend whom you'd watched die a painful, slow death, whom you knew had been placed into a tomb 3 days before, were suddenly alive? Would you believe it? As the late Carl Sagan liked to say, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. But of course, the story has a happy ending. Thomas does see the Lord a week later, and Jesus doesn't rebuke him. In fact, he agrees to Thomas' request and offers his hands and his side as evidence. And Thomas' reaction is very profound. "My Lord and my God," he proclaims. Now that he'd seen the Lord, he realized that he truly was encountering God. And it's not clear that the other disciples had even made that connection. But then Jesus says to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." You know, many biblical scholars think that those words are not so much addressed to Thomas and the other disciples as to the community to whom John was writing decades later. By that time, the generation who had directly experienced Jesus' earthly ministry had mostly died off. And those from another generation with no personal experience of Christ were being asked to believe in him and in his message. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe. And you see, that's also addressed to us. We who don't have any personal, intimate experience of Christ that his disciples had, we're also admonished to believe. And the question that each of us has to answer for his or herself is just this: will we? Should we? You know, many have taken from this story of doubting Thomas the impression that doubt is wrong or sinful, that we shouldn't question the orthodoxies of our faith tradition. But I don't think that's the right interpretation. You see, the opposite of doubt isn't faith. It's either naivete or dogmatism. It's either a willingness to believe anything, no matter how outlandish, or its insistence that our beliefs can't be scrutinized in the light of reason and common sense, that we should leave our brains at the church door. That's probably what Mark Twain had in mind when he wrote, "Faith is believing what you know ain't so." Well, I wouldn't go that far. But I do think that unquestioning faith, blind faith, often leaves you believing things that you know in your heart just couldn't be true. And when you buy into that mindset, you're building for yourself a house of cards that can come crashing down around you at any moment. Our denomination's former moderator, the Reverend Elder Nancy Wilson, describes in her book, Our Tribe, a lecture that she gave at her alma mater, Allegheny College in Pennsylvania. Her lecture was called Outing the Bible. And you can probably guess what that stirred up. During the question and answer period, she was confronted by some conservative Christian students. And let me read you what she says. They were outwardly polite, white, mostly middle-class students, wide-eyed with sincerity. I tried to understand their intensity and fear. Students who I assumed, perhaps falsely, could tolerate ambiguity, fine distinctions, and unresolved questions in other areas of inquiry, could not do so with the Bible. The atmosphere became ritualistic, cult-like, as one young woman repeated over and over again that if I could speculate, I had enraged her by using that word, about homosexuals in the Bible, then one could speculate about anything in the Bible, which apparently would ruin it. It was as if these young students believed the Bible to be a fragile magic snow castle ready to melt, or a row of dominoes ready to fall with the first invading question, unquote. That's the problem with being unwilling to doubt, isn't it? Maybe you've worked out for yourself an acceptable and comfortable interpretation of Scripture and constructed a life based on that interpretation. And then someone authoritative and articulate like Nancy Wilson comes along and suggests that just maybe things aren't nearly as clear-cut as you've always believed them to be. Red lights start flashing, danger. What she's saying sounds reasonable enough, but you can't let that first domino fall, can you? Or who knows where this might end? And so you close your ears and you close your mind and you use those Bible verses you've carefully memorized as a shield and a weapon to bash others into conformity or into silence or to drive them out of the temple like Jesus with the money changers. And the Bible can be a pretty effective weapon. Those of us in the GLBTQ community certainly know that, don't we? We've been on the receiving end of our own texts of terror for generations. Take a few isolated verses from Leviticus or Romans, throw in some sloppy translation, some uncritical exegesis, and pretty soon you've built for yourself a pretty solid case that the Bible condemns gay folks. And with the Bible on your side, you can justify discrimination or even violence against GLBTQ folks. And if you ever admit that maybe you've been wrong all along in your belief that those gay folks were sick or sinful, that they were a threat to marriage and family and children and everything good and holy, then who knows what other dominoes might begin to fall. And heaven forfend, maybe you'll even have to give up your most treasured belief, your belief that you have the right to say who is and is not acceptable in God's sight, that you own the Bible and get to say what it means. So the conclusion is clear, isn't it? If you doubt, you're doomed. Problem is, that's just baloney. Everyone knows you can't live successfully or safely in this world of ours without doubting a lot of the things you've been told. We know that in our everyday lives. Why shouldn't it be true for our faith lives as well? Fact is, doubt isn't antithetical to faith. Doubt is necessary for a mature faith. And there are lots of things that some so-called religious authorities say that I have reason to doubt. Some will tell you that every word in the Bible is literally true, but I doubt it. I agree with Bishop John Spong when he says that you can either take the Bible seriously or you can take it literally, but you can't do both. Some will tell you that God is an angry, vindictive tyrant just looking for any excuse to punish us. But I doubt it. That's not the heavenly parent that Jesus Christ revealed to us. Some will tell you that God punishes the innocent for the acts of the guilty, something we hear every time there's a major earthquake or hurricane. But I doubt it. The God I worship is more just and loving than that. Some will tell you that God made each of us male or female and ordained fixed roles for us based on our gender. But I doubt it. After all, Ginger Rogers danced just as well as Fred Astaire, only backwards and in high heels. Some will tell you that same-gender relationships are inherently inferior to heterosexual relationships. But I doubt it. All I have to do is look around this room to know that that's not true. And some will tell you that God condemns the vast majority of humanity simply because they never had the opportunity or the desire to embrace Christianity. But I doubt it. I trust that God honors and rewards the integrity and the sincerity of others' spiritual journeys as much as mine. And why do I doubt these things? Because they don't line up with the one thing that I have never doubted, the one thing that I believe with all my mind and my heart. And that belief is this: God is love, a love that desires only the best for us, a love that reaches out to us even when we turn away, a love that searches for us even when we hide, A love that forgives us even when we have trouble forgiving ourselves. A love that's universal, unconditional, and so expansive that it doesn't really matter whether you believe what I believe or worship in the same way I worship, because it's not up to me to exclude you from the circle of God's love. My responsibility only and always is to reflect the light of God's love into your lives. And that I don't doubt. You know, I'd be willing to bet that doubt is what led many of you here. Maybe you belong to another faith community where doubt was discouraged. Questions were quarantined, wondering wasn't welcomed. And maybe you left that community because you no longer bought what they were selling. Or maybe you were shown the door because you expressed your doubts about the creeds they professed and the beliefs they held and the professions of faith they demanded of you. Or maybe it was they who doubted your fitness to be a member of their community because you didn't fit their model of what a Christian should look like or act like. Well, however the details played out, doubt was a major factor of why you left. And now, with doubt still in hand, here you are. And maybe some of you feel that this church is your last chance, because here you finally found a community that seems at least to welcome you as you are, doubts and all. But I think it's more hopeful and maybe even more accurate to say that for many of us, this church is our first chance. Our first chance to be authentically and proudly who we are. Our first chance to be in a community without hiding some aspect of ourselves or our faith. Our first chance to be in a community where we can allow our beliefs to change and grow and mature. That's certainly what I've found here at MCC Austin. A community continually struggling, yes, to find a better way to see and a better way to describe our experience as religious people. And we don't claim to have all the answers. We don't demand that you adhere to any specific set of beliefs or even to a specific set of questions. We encourage you to hang on to your doubts. They're part of who you are, part of your spiritual journey. It's our doubts that keep us honest. Because doubt is really only about admitting that there's a lot we still don't understand. As the psychologist Gordon Allport once wrote, "The surest way to lose the truth is to pretend you already possess it." And as St. Paul said, "Now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face." The artist Paul Gardner once said, "A painting is never finished. It simply stops in interesting places." I think that our faith and our beliefs should be like that. They may mature, but they're never really finished. We should always keep growing, learning, changing, and doubting as long as we're alive. But it's okay to stop in interesting places along the way. I hope that MCC Austin is one of those interesting places where you can stop for a while. Just don't expect us to have all the answers or even all the questions. And if anybody ever tells you that we do, just tell them from me, I doubt it. Amen.